honest? I noted Bert's obvious excitement. I guess it was a question of pride. Bert and Ernie wanted to be on the road, hauling colonists. Orbiting Vulcan, acting as floating warehouses, just didn't cut it. Bert sat and accepted a coffee from Jeeves.
It looks like Exodus 3 will be here mid-next year.
Yep. Riker told Sam to take it a bit slow on the flight to give us more lead time. We agreed to get the Spitz off Earth within 6 months of the first two ships. Nothing was said about arrival times.
Oh, lawyering. Makes the universe go round.
I smiled, then grew serious. We've needed the extra time. Milo wasn't kidding about Vulcan's ecosystem. They've had to go back and reinforce the fence, then add electrical wiring to dissuade the Brontos from chewing on it, and to keep out the raptors, and the giant snake things, and those burrowing armadillo things. I shook my head. We're making progress, but it's like wading through molasses sometimes.
Well, not really my problem.
Bert took a sip of coffee.
Shuttle start moving people down this afternoon. Just make sure you have somewhere to put them. I'm about ready to just hover over the tarmac and turn the shuttle sideways to dump them out.
He grinned to show he wasn't serious, or at least not completely so. Okay, Bert, I'll let the colonel know. He finished his coffee, disappeared the cup, and popped out with a wave.
6. Contacting Bill.
Mulder, April 2171. Poseidon. Subspace Communications Universal Transceiver. Kind of forced, but we had a tradition, going back to Faith, of bad acronyms. The radio transmission from Bill contained a complete set of plans and operating instructions. So, I built the scut from Bill's transmitted plans, and now I was ready for the magic moment. I just hoped it wouldn't blow up. I flipped the switch, and the console immediately started scrolling information. Sol, Epsilon Eridani, Alpha Centauri, Omicron Squared Eridani. I followed the menu prompts and registered myself on the network, then selected Epsilon Eridani and pressed Connect. The transmitting icon came on, and I began to speak. Hi, Bill. This is Mulder out at Eta Cassiopeiae. I found Bill popped into my VR. Hi, Mulder. How's Trix? Holy. I was speechless. It was just under 20 light years from here to Epsilon Eridani. Yet this was Bill sitting across from me in my VR. Bill laughed. It never gets old. Welcome to BobNet. Instantaneous communications across interstellar space. He waggled his eyebrows at me in our standard Groucho Marx impersonation and took a sip of his coffee. I nodded slowly in appreciation. And is that your standard entrance? Oh, hell yes. And I'm keeping track, notches on the holster and all. We both laughed, and I materialized a coffee of my own. This was huge. Real-time communications changed everything. No more decades-long turnaround times for communications. So, anything interesting here? Bill waved his coffee in a vague, out-there gesture. I think so. We have a colonization target. It's not ideal, but I don't know if you're in a position to be picky, or if we even need colonization targets. Did Riker find anything? I pushed a file towards him. Bill went into Framejack for a moment while he absorbed the contents. When his avatar unfroze, he looked pleased. Not bad. I see your point, though. Colonists would have to establish a space presence immediately. Still, to answer the question, no, we're not in a position to be picky right now, and yes, Riker found something. Check out his blog on BobNet. We spent several more seconds getting caught up, and I promised to read all the blogs. Bill gave me a wave and popped out. Well, that was interesting. It appeared I should put some effort into preparing this system. The standard plan was to have a supply of refined metals available in orbit when the colonists arrived, and I'd have to ride a bestiary with detailed information. Some of the creatures in-planet were truly impressive by any definition. The Kraken, especially, needed an entire chapter of its own. Time to buckle down and get serious.
7. Back to work. Riker, July 2171, Sol.
I looked at my list of to-dos for the day and sighed. I was a little surprised at how much I was missing my family. Julia and Clan Bob were all aboard Exodus 3, in stasis, heading for Omicron Squared Eridani. There would be no contact until they arrived at their destination and were revived. I tried to remind myself that it was an eye blink at my life scale, but any way I looked at it, I would still have to experience every day of those 17 years. 24-hour days since I didn't sleep, experienced in millisecond intervals. This train of thought seemed destined to send me into a deep funk. With an effort of will, I brought myself to task. The first item, as always, was a status check on colony ship construction. I checked the summary window rather than doing a personal inspection. Unless some significant step was due, I didn't need to micromanage. At that moment, Charles popped into my VR. "Hey, Riker." One of the first clones I'd made here in the solar system. Charles was still hanging around and helping out. He knew the politics of Earth almost as well as I, and the location of everything in the rest of the system far better. If he ever decided to leave, it would be crippling. "Charles, what's up?"
"I wanted to update you on the sabotage."
"So, what's the scoop?"
It looks like we've got two different groups working. Vehement is definitely behind the attacks on infrastructure. They've left the usual calling cards afterwards. Everything is designed to target food production. They're very tech-savvy and obviously know what they're doing."
Vehement appeared to be some kind of radical environmental group whose ultimate goal was to save the world by removing humanity. And they weren't picky about ethical questions when it came to their methods. Charles popped up a couple of images and samples of the Vehement statements. He waited for me to review them before continuing. Some were the typical pompous ravings of self-important people, all pronouncements and assertions written with nose firmly in the air. Others were acerbic and even ironic. This latest fell into the latter category. "A friendly reminder that you are a scourge on the universe. Do it a favor and disappear. This public service message brought to you by Voluntary Extinction of Human Existence means Earth's natural transformation." Charles continued when he saw he had my attention.
"The attacks on Florianopolis don't fit the profile, though. There's no announcement afterwards, and the attacks seem aimed at maximizing fatalities rather than damaging infrastructure. They're not sophisticated either, mostly just brute force explosives. I think those are just attacks on Brazil, or what's left of it. There's still a lot of resentment against them for the war."
I nodded thoughtfully. This confirmed my private opinion. "That also means the second group might not be a single organization. It could be multiple groups or even independent individual actions."
"Agreed. For all that, more people are dying in those acts. It's less of a long-term issue and can be handled by local law enforcement. The Vehement stuff worries me a lot more."
"Mm-hmm. They haven't gotten at any of our space-based assets, but considering the technological expertise they've already displayed, I wouldn't be surprised if they figured out a way."
I had my mouth open to describe the steps I was taking to track them down, but then hesitated. I wasn't entirely sure why. I couldn't realistically suspect Charles of anything, but I got a sudden feeling that I should play this close to the vest. Vehement was good. Maybe they could decrypt communications between Bobs. I had implemented full scanning of all communications in the solar system. A half dozen Amys monitored all communications, watching for keywords or patterns. It was a scattershot tactic, but I really had no other options. There was no reason to inform the other Bobs. I wanted them to act natural anyway. Charles interrupted my train of thought. "How's the construction going?"
I was just checking that. Generally still on track. I'm going to check with Homer next about food production."
Charles nodded. "Okay, let me know if you need any help in that area."
I gave Charles a nod and he saluted and popped out.
Next on the list was food production. I sent Homer a quick text about the space-based production facilities, and he reported that the wheels of industry were turning smoothly. I smiled at his response. I'd taken to calling him General Bull Moose, and rather than take offense, he thought it was hilarious. Typical Homer. My smile disappeared as I pored over the attached spreadsheet. Food production Earthside continued to drop as the climate deteriorated. The pounding that the planet had taken during the war was sending Earth into an ice age. As the glaciers advanced and snow accumulated farther and farther from the poles, arable land became tundra, then tundra became ice. We had to balance food production with moving higher latitude enclaves into more equatorial locations. Homer's space-based farms were taking a lot of the pressure off. As each farm donut was spun up and began producing crops, we were able to move estimated time of habitable Earth remaining later by a couple of years. The farm donuts were Homer's idea, and he ran them like a military operation. However, the 30,000 people we'd managed to get off planet so far were barely a drop in the bucket. 15 million human beings were all that was left of Homo sapiens. But it was still a lot of bodies to move. 1,500 ships or 1,500 trips. I put down the document and took a moment to massage my forehead. The UN session had started a few minutes ago, and I needed to be there. Highlight of my day, for sure. Not. Since the departure of the USE and Spitz enclaves and the first two ships, I didn't really have anyone I talked with regularly. All the other enclaves maintained a very arm's-length relationship, except for a few, like New Zealand, who were actively antagonistic. Between that and my relatives being in stasis, I felt very isolated these days. Well, at least today's session would be interesting. We'd just gotten word about Poseidon from Mulder at Eta Cassiopeiae. The biology was compatible, and the floating mats were more than adequate to live on, at least in the short term. Longer term, the system had enough resources to support construction of floating cities. Several of the smaller island nation enclaves had expressed an interest. The problem was one of priority. Exodus 4 and 5 were almost finished. Would we send one to Poseidon, or send both to Omicron Squared Eridani? The member from the Maldives was speaking. Representative Sharma was campaigning hard on behalf of the tropical island nations. Common wisdom held that they should be last out since their climate was still the most moderate.
Yes, as the representative from Vancouver Island has pointed out repeatedly, the Maldives and other equatorial nations still have moderate climates. What the representative has failed to do is explain why that matters. If we emigrate, our lands become available for those in extreme hardship. Either way, the hardship cases are ameliorated.
She motioned to the image of Poseidon.
The important question is whether we settle a second system or whether we continue to pour all of our emigrants into Omicron Squared Eridani. We are better off now as a species than we were a few years ago. We are spread through two star systems. But three systems would be better, and four even more so. All other things being equal, let us at least go for three. The challenge to the member from Vancouver Island and to other objectors is to show specifically why things are not equal and not by using faulty associations.
Representative Sharma stuck out her chin defiantly, held the pose for just the right beat, then released the audio, giving up the floor. I wanted to clap, but that would be unseemly. I really had no particular skin in the game on this issue, but I agreed about distributing humanity as widely as possible. The species had just finished almost wiping itself out in a single system. You'd think people would grow a brain. I looked at the board. More than half of the request to speak indicators were lit up. I sighed, disconnected from my public avatar for a moment, massaged my forehead again, and wondered for the thousandth time how I'd let myself get roped into this duty. I hoped today they'd call for a vote. 8. Farming Satellites. Howard, April 2189, Vulcan. The holotank glowed with overlapping information windows, all competing for attention. Several nodes blinked red, demanding immediate input. I cranked up my frame rate a little, not enough to overload the VR hardware, just enough to be able to get ahead of all the demands on my attention. Guppy, you've got coordination of the drone mule team, right?
Affirmative.
Good thing. I thought my head was about to explode. We were about to spin up the third farm donut, which would increase our capacity just in time for the arrival of the third colony ship. Farm 1 and Farm 2 were already in full operation, generating a comfortable 0.25G in the rim. Riker and Homer had found through trial and error that crops didn't do well below that level of gravity. Specialized drones maintained the farm sections, which were producing all the kudzu you could eat. Yum. Of course, I didn't have to eat it, what with being a computer and all, but the humans were not so lucky. Until the colonies were to the point of being self-sustaining, everyone's daily calorie intake was up to 50% kudzu. And because of kudzu's digestive side effects, meals and other social gatherings tended to be outside or involve open windows. One of the status windows dinged. Guppy was starting the spin-up of Farm 3. After a lot of debate, filled with discussion of gyroscopes, compressed air propulsion, and traditional JATO units, Homer had settled on a very old-school system for spinning up the orbital farms, which we were still using. We tethered 4 drones to the rim with cables 90 degrees apart and had them fly in circles until we achieved the proper RPM. Primitive, but effective. I watched the status displays as Farm 3 came up to speed. No issues, and more importantly, no sabotage. It seemed that Vehement was either still completely confined to the Sol system, or they hadn't acquired any assets here, but we didn't know how many members might have gone out with the various colony ships. We would have to be vigilant until humanity was well enough established to survive its own craziness. I shook my head. Enough daydreaming. I ran final checks on Farm 3, then directed Guppy to start planting operations. Farm 3 would grow regular crops, vegetables, wheat, berries, stuff people actually wanted to eat. I really needed to get this right, or there would be talk of lynching. Coming up on Beacon, 50 clicks and closing. Sam's image floated beside the system schematic. Exodus 3 was on track to merge neatly with the L4 point shared by the twin planets, Vulcan and Romulus. The Vulcan colony had declared a holiday, as it was unlikely anyone would be getting anything done anyway. I was transmitting my displays down to the Landing City Network, which was broadcasting out to every TV in town. Exodus 3 slid up beside the communication beacon without as much as a wobble. Sam ran through his shutdown checklist and changed status to station keeping. With the formalities out of the way, I popped over to his VR. "Welcome, Howard. Pull up a chair." Sam waved a coffee mug in the general direction of a Victorian wingback. I looked around his VR. It had the feel of an old English drawing room, the kind of place Sherlock Holmes might have hung out. Sam was drinking a coffee, but a quick inspection of the menu showed that I could order from a broad selection of drinks. I decided to see how well Sam had simulated cognac. I indicated my choice to Jeeves and sat down. "I've started to decant the setup crews," Sam said. "I looked over the maps and resource summaries that you provided. Pretty thorough." He grimaced for a fraction of a millisecond. "No doubt Cranston will still find something to complain about." I accepted the glass of cognac from Jeeves and took a moment to taste it. "Not bad." "Quite good, really." Sam had obviously spent some time getting it right. I set a to-do to ask him for the template. I put the glass down and leaned forward. "Your colonists will really need to tread lightly on Romulus. Milo was right. There was a recent extinction event, and the ecosystem is still very shallow. No large-scale clearing, and especially don't let any Terran biota get loose. Make sure both colony groups understand that." Sam nodded, eyes focused on infinity. With an obvious effort, he turned his attention back to me. "You're really lucky, Howard, getting to see the colonies in the early stages like this. A lot more exciting than driving a bus. I'll be leaving in a month or two to go pick up another load." "Sure, Sam, but I keep a blog. And lots of videos of anything that's even remotely interesting. Yeah, it's not real time, but the universe is our playground now, you know?" He grinned in response. We spent a few seconds getting caught up on gossip, then moved on to the serious business of setting up a colony of 10,000 people on an alien world. Just another day at the office. Only 2 days after the first Faith and Spitz personnel were decanted and everyone was already at war. Or maybe back at war was more accurate. The three-way battle between the USE, Faith, and the Spitsbergen Enclave for berths in the first colony ships had been a major pain in the ass for Riker back at Earth. It appeared that not much had changed, and now I'd inherited the problem. You couldn't actually come to blows in a video conference, of course, but the blustering and yelling more than made up for the lack of bloodshed. I put my head in my hand and shook it slowly back and forth. It took a few seconds for everyone to notice, then the yelling petered out. "Tell you what," I said. "How does pistols at dawn sound? Three ways. That should be interesting." President Valter looked slightly sheepish, Minister Cranston indignant, and Colonel Butterworth amused, but at least they'd shut it. The three colony leaders settled themselves behind their desks and waited for me to continue. "I understand a certain amount of competitiveness," I said, looking at each person's image in turn. "But isolationism will just get you dead. And I sure as hell will not buttress any such attitude with extra support." Cranston's face turned red. "You are not in charge, replicant. We will make our own decisions about what's best for us. What makes you think you have the right to dictate, or for that matter, the moral high ground?" I tilted my head and smiled innocently at the leader of the Faith colony. I'm trying to remember now. Of all of us here, everyone who didn't participate in a war that virtually destroyed the human race, please raise your hand. I raised a hand and waited a moment to see if anyone else would have the gall to do so. "I'm a neutral party here, Mr. Cranston. Yeah, even with jerks who treat me as a piece of equipment instead of addressing me by name. But I'm also a volunteer. I'll help who I want, and I'll leave if I want. As a good leader, you should take that datum into account when deciding how much of an idiot you want to be." I glared at the three video windows. No one responded. After a moment of awkward silence, Valter said, "Very well. We will trade some of our decanted livestock, if necessary, for future considerations. Howard, I am hoping you will act as adjudicator in such cases."
"Absolutely, Mr. Valter.
And thank you. Colonel, some breeding stock now will help you until we're finished forced growing the animals in the artificial wombs." I turned to Cranston. "Minister? Your repayment should consist of setting up and running a large batch of artificial wombs to take the pressure off the Spitz. The both of you can pay them back with interest once your own stock is high enough." I looked around at the various windows. No one commented. With a sigh, I checked my agenda for the next discussion item.
"You show a lot more patience than Riker ever did."
Colonel Butterworth raised a glass of Jameson toward me. "Thanks, Colonel, I think. We Bobs are definitely different as individuals. I wonder why they never picked up on that back on Earth when they were working on the whole replicant thing." Butterworth shrugged. Sciencey stuff like that didn't interest him, except to the extent it affected his job. He poked at a pile of paper on his desk.
"This native vine that I mentioned before is turning into a significant problem. The level of invasiveness puts anything from Earth to shame, except possibly bamboo. If we don't get ahead of it, we might end up expending all our energy just beating it back."
The native ecosystem has the home court advantage, unfortunately. Doesn't it serve as food for any native species?
As far as my scientists can tell, it contains a toxin of some kind that the native browsers find disagreeable. Even the Brontos won't eat it, and they are the unpickiest herbivores I've ever seen.
I laughed. The Brontos would eat almost anything that provided net calories. They would eat all the leaves from a tree, then the twigs, then the bark from the main trunk, and branches. What they left behind looked very sad. Fortunately, Vulcan trees could survive having their bark stripped. The Brontos had even started munching on the fence when they could get close enough. A couple of strings of electrified wire had nipped that habit before it could catch on. "How does it affect people?" Butterworth shook his head.
"The vine is not edible as such. However, the toxin doesn't seem particularly effective against Terran biology. As soon as we have some livestock, we'll see if they'll eat it.
I nodded silently. Colonizing an alien planet, as with everything else, was more complicated than TV and movies let on. Clearing the land and building houses was just the beginning. We had neither the resources nor the desire to commit planetary ecological genocide, and doing so would doom the colony anyway. But learning to live here was going to be a case of mutual accommodation. Fortunately, so far, no alien diseases had found humans compatible. I wasn't really surprised. Even Terran viruses were generally specialized for a specific species or lifestyle. Eventually, something would make the jump, but by then we would hopefully be ready for it. The colonel brought up a few more minor items, then we signed off. So far, so good. But my movie-conditioned mind was still waiting for the inevitable disaster. 9. Something is out there. Bob, September 2169, Delta Eridani. Marvin popped in and started to speak several times without success. I couldn't identify the expression on his face, but it reminded me of a fish that had just eaten a lemon. Something was definitely up. I'd been going over the auto factory schedule with Guppy. I turned back to him. It doesn't look like there are any surprises. Make the changes I've listed and let me know if anything goes off schedule.
Arr!
Guppy blinked huge fish eyes once and disappeared. Marvin was still doing a pretty good imitation of a fish himself. I grinned at him. Come on, Marv, spit it out. You know you wanna... He took a deep breath. Something, and by something, I mean damned if I know what, hunted the Deltans almost to extinction at their original location. Say what? I found a number of disarticulated Deltan remains in different places, so it wasn't just a one-time thing. The damage was not indicative of gorilloids. We've seen their work. They're lazy. They strip the meat, not even thoroughly, then go back for a new victim. Whatever this was, it did the full workup, and chew marks on the bones indicate something much bigger than a gorilloid. I sat back and rubbed my chin and thought for a moment. So there's another apex predator out there. Great. I may have to break out the exploration drones and put them on a kilometer-by-kilometer survey. I think that would be a good idea, buddy. If we have the printer cycles to spare, maybe print up a few more sets of drones. Of course, because screwing with the auto factory schedule is never a problem. I stood up, stretched, and wandered to the end of the library, gazing at nothing. After a moment's thought, I pulled up the files from my initial exploration of Delta Eridani 4. I knew that my survey had been less than thorough, but I wasn't a professional exobiologist, assuming such a job had ever even existed. And once I'd found the Deltans, everything else had taken a back seat. I replaced the library bookshelves with a blank wall and spread the images of the fauna I'd cataloged across its length. Pacing along the collage of images, I tried to imagine any of them able to take out a full-grown Deltan. Marvin materialized a lazy boy and settled in with a coffee. Spike immediately assumed an invitation and hopped up to settle in his lap. The collage offered no inspiration. The leopard analogs and the gorilloids were really the only animals I'd encountered that would prey on Deltans, and they just didn't fit the bill. I waved a hand and killed the collage. In frustration, I canceled the room VR and activated my Deltan Village VR. Marvin jerked in surprise and Spike leaped up and fled. I felt a moment's guilt for not warning him. Marvin gave me the Spock eyebrow, and I answered with an apologetic grimace, then turned and started walking through the village. The recording was incredibly detailed, but still, just a recording. No interaction was possible. I wished for the millionth time that I could interact with the Deltans through something a little more immediate than a floating mechanical football. Finally, I turned back to Marvin, who had refused to give up his lazy boy. He was reclining, drinking a coffee, right in the middle of a group of Deltans who were skinning a pigoid. I laughed and he grinned back. Okay, Marvin, let's get going on that search. Guppy? Guppy popped into existence.
You rang?
Cute. I suspected that Marvin was feeding lines to Guppy just to bug me. Printer schedule change, Guppy. Print up 4 more complete squads of exploration drones. Looks like we're going snipe hunting. Guppy's huge fish eyes blinked.
This will result in another delay in the armaments project. I remind you that you have assigned that project high priority.
That's fine. I think we're ahead of the curve with the gorilloids. Attempted attacks are down to almost zero. We've got enough spare busters to bash their heads if they try any kind of large-scale attack. Guppy nodded and disappeared. Marvin stood up and waved the chair away.
I'll get started on the full survey as soon as they're ready. Meanwhile, I'll map out some search strategies.
We gave each other a wave and he disappeared. I closed the village VR and brought back my library.
10. Genocide. Mario. November 2176. Zeta Tucani. It took 7 years plus change to get from Beta Hydri to Zeta Tucani, although less than 3 years ship's time. I spent almost the entire voyage going over the records from Beta Hydri 4. I didn't want to believe that someone could have done that. I wanted so much for it to be a natural disaster of some kind. But the evidence was, if not conclusive, at least pretty damned convincing. Someone had killed off an entire planet and collected all the bodies, literally all the animal life on the planet, then mined all the metals from the entire system. My mind kept playing all the movies where aliens came in and tried to strip the Earth. This was worse. They killed everything, and they left nothing. But how? And why? I sighed and dismissed the theorizing for perhaps the 1,000th time. I couldn't know without more information, but I wasn't going to wait. I needed to report this to Bill. The Bobs needed to be warned. I couldn't know in advance if Zeta Tucani would be stripped of metal as well. If so, I would just skip to the next system and keep doing so until I either found a good star system in which to build a space station or had traveled back close enough to simply transmit a message to Bill with shipboard comms. I did the usual cautious approach into the star system, watching for Medeiros, aliens, other probes. It would be funny if I wasn't so nervous. I didn't actually know if there were more Medeiros clones out in the galaxy, but since Brazil's plan had been to keep producing them, it seemed a reasonable concern. Bob had prevailed against him in Epsilon Eridani, but that had been as much luck as anything. It took a week or so to determine the system layout. The star was a little more luminous than Sol and a bit bigger but slightly less massive. The metallicity of the system was lower, but not so low as to make things difficult for me, as long as the others hadn't already cleaned it out. I found a single asteroid belt and several inner rocky planets. Actually, this system was similar enough to Earth's to make me a little homesick. I headed for the asteroid belt while I continued to scan for any activity. I went about halfway around the belt before giving up. The others had already cleaned up here as well. I decided I would get a quick look at the single planet in the habitable zone, then continue on to the next system on my list. What I found was the worst possible outcome. Exploring the planet through various drone cameras, I could see that something had caused massive destruction. Based on the ruined structures, entire cities had been taken apart. Concrete pylons indicated where bridges might once have spanned rivers. Huge washouts indicated where dams had been disassembled without regard for the downriver effects. And junk littered what looked like roadways where, presumably, the contents of some kind of vehicles had simply been discarded when the metal and the passengers were collected. Guppy, I need a full scan of the planet. Set up the drones to do polar orbits and get the whole surface. Guppy nodded without comment and went into command fugue. I sensed the blips as more drones launched. I settled back to wait. If I'd been still living, I would have thrown up. As it was, I couldn't watch for long. The destruction was total, the devastation worldwide. These, whatever they were, these others, had callously killed billions of sentient beings, the way a construction crew would clear the ground before starting to build. And I could think of only one reason for collecting the dead bodies. When we met them, it would be war. 11. Mating Dance. Bob, November 2169, Delta Eridani. The Deltans were coming into their breeding season, and the tension in Camelot was climbing. In the past, stressors like the gorilloid threat had kept things low-key. It's hard to get amorous when you're looking over your shoulder every few seconds. But this year, the Deltans were top dogs in their environment. The gorilloids had finally figured out the new pecking order. There hadn't been an attack in almost a month. A lot of that was due to the busters. Any gorilloid coming within a certain distance of Camelot was met head-on by a 40-pound ball of steel. The encounter was fatal to both. But I could produce more busters faster than the gorilloids could produce more gorilloids. The Deltans rarely even looked up anymore at the occasional sonic boom. I knew more or less what to expect from previous years. Male Deltans vied for the attentions of the females in any of a number of ways. Wrestling matches, mock battles, tests of skill, even good old-fashioned bluff and bluster. It was great fun to watch, and generally no one got badly hurt. This year, though, Archimedes had introduced a new test of skill, spear chucking. And you couldn't refuse a challenge, but that wasn't working out entirely in Archimedes' favor. The other young males had figured out that they should avoid that particular contest with him, so they were challenging Archimedes first, based on contests of strength. Unfortunately, Archimedes was rather bookish, as Deltans went. I wondered if nerddom was a universal thing. After Archimedes got dropped on his head in a couple of encounters, I decided to teach him some basic jiu-jitsu. It turned out to be harder than expected because the Deltan skeletal system didn't always bend the same way as a human's would. We had to improvise a few locks and throws based on their different physiology. But the principles were still applicable, and Archimedes was motivated. We narrowed it down to the five or so most useful moves. He spent a day going through the steps in pantomime, establishing the muscle memory before he rejoined the circus. Almost immediately, a couple of young toughs tried to push him around to establish dominance. His response was slow and tentative, but it was a completely new concept, and his opponents didn't even recognize the danger until they were on their butts looking up at him. After that, Archimedes strutted around the village like he owned the place. Marvin laughed, watching all the antics. "I'm sure there's some element of vengeance in there, getting back at all the childhood bullies by proxy, perchance. You know, Marvin, this habit of yours of analyzing my motives is a real pain in the ass, especially since they were your childhood tormentors, too." Marvin grinned and waggled his eyebrows. Sadly, he was probably right about my motivation. I was doing what I could to make sure Archimedes did better at the metaphorical mating dance than I had as a teenager. And the more descendants Archimedes created, the sooner the entire tribe would be at or near his level of intelligence. Win-win, as far as I was concerned. "Now, if you could only change Archimedes' mind," Marvin observed. "Yeah, I know. Having kicked butt yet again, Archimedes was making the moves on Diana. She had to be a knockout in Deltan terms, because I couldn't figure out what else he could see in her. She intensely disliked the drones and wouldn't hang around anywhere near us when I was with Archimedes.
An obvious symptom of low intelligence in my books."
Marvin popped in without warning. "Things just got creepier." I looked up from the observation window. The mating season was almost done. Most pairings had been decided by this point, but some Deltans hadn't gotten the memo. You could tell when that happened because the miscreant would find himself, and sometimes herself, being beaten on by both members of the pairing on which he or she was trying to intrude. This was usually enough to make the point, but there were three or four individuals left who couldn't seem to take "get lost" for an answer. Archimedes and Diana had formalized their mating without further challenge, so it was purely scientific interest on my part. I glared at Marvin, ready with a sarcastic comment about the interruption, but I changed my mind when I saw his face. He looked distinctly freaked out, and Marvin tended to be level-headed. I set the video window to record and minimized it. Okay, Marv, what's up? With a flick of a finger, Marvin popped up an image in midair showing an ancient set of bones. By this point, we were both experienced enough with all things Delton to recognize parts of a Delton skeleton. And this one had the bite and claw marks that I'd seen on some of Marvin's other specimens. Looks like another victim of the mystery predator. What's special about this one?
I found it less than a mile from Camelot.
Oh, son of a bitch. If the range of this thing included the immediate area and it was still around, I may have brought the Deltons back to be the main course. I remembered some comments that had been made when the Deltons first arrived at Camelot. In particular, one of the elders hadn't been happy with the explanation that it was the gorilloids that had driven the Deltons out. Unfortunately, he'd only had vague memories to support his feeling. I grabbed a drone and went looking for Moses or Archimedes. I found Archimedes first, fortunately not with Diana, and explained the situation to him.
"That's not good," he said. "If we were safer at the old site, and you brought us back here..."
"Yeah, I know, Archimedes, don't rub it in. On the plus side, we may have some lead time to prepare, but I need to find the elder who was making those comments."
"Moses would know, I think."
We found Moses with very little effort. He'd found and laid claim to a favorite lounging spot on the south side of the bluff where he spent his afternoons sitting in the sun, relieving the pain of his stiff joints. I allowed myself a moment of sadness. Moses seemed to have entered that long slide into failing health that was all too common in the elderly. I went through the story again.
It does sound familiar,
he said thoughtfully.
That was Axler, I think.
The translation routine was programmed to render Delton names in human pronounceable sounds. It would tag that particular translation for permanent association with the name.
Sadly, he died 3 or 4 hands ago. I don't think anyone else is even close to that old.
Wonderful, I said. Archimedes, Moses, don't say anything to anyone else about this. I don't want to start a panic without more information. Marvin and I will do some more investigations. I will also set some drones to a wide perimeter guard. If anyone sees them and asks, just tell them I'm doing a gorilloid count. The two nodded, both looking worried.
But where have they gone?
Marvin scratched his head, staring at the globe.
Look, maybe Deltons weren't their primary prey. Maybe they discovered that Deltons were delicious and started hunting them preferentially. After the Deltons left, they would have just gone back to whatever they normally hunted.
Right. Which is why I've expanded the search. But let's face it, we're talking about millions of square miles. A predator can have quite a range. As he talked, Marvin was dividing the land area on the continent into segments. I could see from the metadata that he was assigning drones to each segment. He sat back and stared at the results. After a few moments of consideration, he handed it off to Guppy for implementation and turned to face me.
How are we for busters?
I raised my eyebrows in alarm.
Damn. Good point.
I haven't been keeping up with production. Between the gorilloids all growing a collective brain and us taking the printers off schedule to build the extra exploration drones, we're down to less than a dozen.
Marvin grinned. Well, there goes the schedule again, I guess.
12. Bob calling.
Bill. May 2171, Epsilon Eridani.
Incoming Scott connection. New node.
Guppy made the announcement with the same fishy poker face that he would use to announce the end of the world. I looked up and grinned. Garfield dropped the file he was working on and came running over. Only a handful of Bobs so far had received the Scut plans that I'd been broadcasting and had built their own FTL transceiver. Each new connection was an event. I held the moment as long as I could. Just as Garfield drew a breath to yell at me, I said to Guppy, "Play the incoming."
"This is Bob calling."
"Bill, you actually cracked FTL communications? I'm impressed." I did a fist bump, and then Garfield and I whooped and performed a high five. The nerd kind, where you miss. Logically, Bob 1 was no more significant than any other Bob that received the Scut plans, but this wasn't a matter of logic.
Bob One was like Odin the All-Father. He started the whole thing. For me, it was special, since he'd cloned me. For any of the third generation or later Bobs, it would be like legend walking among us. Of course, that wouldn't stop me from pulling the usual prank. I popped into Bob's VR without warning, coffee in hand. I noticed as the VRs synced that he'd been doing some enhancements of his own. The versions weren't incompatible, but there would be video glitches. I'd have to upgrade him to my latest release so he would be fully compatible with BobNet. Holy! Bob jerked in surprise, and Spike bolted from the desk she'd been sitting on. I laughed. Works every time. Hi, Bob. Welcome to BobNet. Bob smiled at the implied tip of the hat. It took a millisecond to look around his VR. This appeared to be a planetary environment, a village of some kind. Some species of natives were going about their business. They were obviously intelligent, since they had spears and axes and stuff. They looked a little like walking bats with a dash of pig thrown in, by way of long snouts with flat nostrils. Their fur was short, generally gray with brown overtones. Kind of ugly, really. The level of detail was impressive, and I couldn't remember any movie or book that featured creatures like this. I looked over at Bob, who was trying to suppress a smug grin. And failing badly. With a jolt, I realized that this had to be real. Or at least a VR based on reality. This was first contact. Keeping my expression neutral, I turned in a circle to take in the full tableau. Who are the neighbors? Bob, now grinning unabashedly, swept a hand around the virtual campground. This is a recording of the Deltons' village. I use this to experience their environment, get a better feel for how they live. Interesting. Have you made contact? There was a barking laugh from off to the side, and I looked over to see another Bob. I turned back to Bob One and was surprised to see he was blushing. That was better VR realism than my version supported. I decided I'd do a merge on the VR features before upgrading him. Bill, this is Marvin. Bob gestured toward the newcomer. He's a disrespectful pain in the ass, and that's one of his better qualities. Marvin and I smiled and nodded to each other. I said, I recognize the tone of that laugh. I guess Bob has gone overboard. Marvin smirked. You might say that. He's become the great volcano god. Did you see the spears and axes? Hey, Bob interjected. I resent that. I'm more of a sky god. We all laughed together. Despite the joking, though, I was still a little lightheaded. An intelligent species, the first we'd ever run across. I had a pretty good idea which blog was going to be number one on BobNet for the next little while. Bob motioned me to a couch and coffee table set up, sitting incongruously in the middle of the native village. So, Bill, what's new in the galaxy? I sat down, accepted a coffee from Jeeves, and took a moment to pat Bob's incarnation of Spike, who had come back to investigate. The cat's AI appeared more independent than my version. Another item to merge. It dawned on me that Bob was still the reigning master of VR coding. Wow, what's been happening? I thought for a moment. Well, Milo discovered two habitable planets at Omicron Squared Eridani, named them Vulcan and Romulus. Bob laughed. Of course he did. What else could he do? I grinned back at him, then got serious. Riker and his clone, Homer, had a big battle in Sol with the last of the Brazilian Space Navy and discovered that humanity had almost wiped itself out in a system-wide war. They're building colony ships and are hoping to get some people to Vulcan before the Earth stops being livable. Bob interrupted. How many people left? About 15 million, give or take. And how big are the colony ships? I nodded, understanding where Bob was going. 10,000 capacity. Yeah, I know. 1,500 ships or 1,500 trips, but we can only do what we can. Bob nodded. He looked worried, and I couldn't blame him. Riker and I had this conversation regularly. So far, we hadn't found any shortcut. I tried to change the subject to lighten the mood. We've got a minimum of about 20 Bobs running around the galaxy right now, by my estimate. I waved a hand in casual dismissal. You know, the usual blah, blah. Bob visibly shook off the funk and tried to smile. Sounds like you've taken to the job of Central Clearinghouse with a vengeance. Got anything going in Epsilon Eridani besides the Scut? I'm slowly terraforming Ragnarok. Riker has sent some seeds and plant samples my way with an outgoing Bob. They should be here in 3 years or so. Then I'll try to get some basic moss-lichen hybrids growing. Oh, and the android project. I've got a quadruped android working, more or less, and I can control it remotely. It's slow going, though, and I've barely scratched the surface. I'll want one of those when they're available, Bob said. I'd like to be able to go down to Eden as an actual presence instead of a floating camera. Hmm, I nodded. It looked like Bob was pretty invested in the lives of the Deltons. No real surprise, though. 13. Investigating the Others. Mario, May 2180, Gliese 54. This time I was lucky. Unlike Beta Hydri and Zeta Tucani, Gliese 54 was untouched. I had no clue about what might determine the course of whatever beings had stripped the two other systems. If they traveled as a single unit, and they were traveling in a straight line, they might never meet up with any of us. My concern was that if they were mining that much metal, they were probably building something. The obvious answer to that would be more of them, and that would be bad. This was not a particularly interesting system. The primary was a small K, almost a red dwarf. It had a single, lonely planet orbiting in close and a bunch of space junk. Of course, space junk was what I needed. Although the overall metallicity of the system was low, most of it hadn't aggregated into planets. The manufacturing process was routine, even if I only had memories of having done it once as Bob won in Epsilon Eridani. It took a couple of months to build and deploy the space station. Once it was up, I squirted every bit of information I had on the others back to Bill. The station had the added bonus that I would be able to transmit to it from any of the stars in the immediate area, and it would relay my messages to Epsilon Eridani. I also decided that I didn't want to be alone. So I started construction of four more Bobs. Bashful, Dopey, Sleepy, and Hungry all agreed to accompany me to deal with the potential threat. Yes, they named themselves after dwarves, and yes, it was pointed out at some length that there was no Hungry in the original crew. Hungry didn't care. Apparently, I can be very perverse. And stubborn. Anyway, there's that joke about the 50 dwarves. We sat around the desk in my treehouse sipping tropical drinks with little umbrellas. Except Hungry, who refused to go along with the theme. He had a coffee. I suggested we rename him Surly and received a middle finger for my trouble. Sleepy opened the discussion.
We have to figure out the vector and size of the invasion or infestation or whatever it is. Is it heading for Earth or away?
And what they're doing with all that metal, if they're building more ships, it must be a massive fleet. How would we not see them coming? Dopey looked around at us, palms up. And all the, food. Yeah, I nodded slowly. We have no information, really. We have to find them. And we have to get a report back without becoming part of their harvest. Their ants are surprisingly efficient. I've learned several things from them, which I've already squirted back Billward. There was silence around the table as everyone digested this.
So, we each pick a system outward and head there, Sleepy said. We should keep a transmission channel open at all times, so we'll have a record if one of us disappears.
Yes, I nodded. The open line should run all the way back to Bill. If necessary, stop and build a relay station. Keep up a constant stream of commentary and observations and send regular differential backups, just in case. Sleepy took a sip of his drink before responding.
Sounds like a plan.
Although I don't like the implications. If I get taken down, the Bob that gets restored won't really be me.
What, you're positing a soul now for us?
Hungry, rolled his eyes.
Every time the crew of Star Trek transported, they faced the same philosophical question.
Sleepy rolled his eyes back at Hungry in exaggerated mockery.
Again with the fictional TV series. Is that where you get all your life lessons?
Hungry frowned.
Well, you should know, shouldn't you? Children, am I going to have to separate you? I glared around the table. Can we focus on the planet-destroying, rampaging alien what's-its for now?
Sleepy and Hungry both looked embarrassed. After a moment of silence, I continued. I would also suggest that we have some kind of self-destruct capability built in. Maybe a dead man trigger. Personally, I don't want to have to feel myself being slowly disassembled if I get caught, and I certainly don't want it or them to learn anything from me. Wow, this is getting morbid. I don't quite feel so negative about the backups now. I chuckled. So let's pick our destination systems, put together a working comms link, and get this show on the road.
14. Sabotage. Riker, December 2170, Seoul. The image on the video made me curl my lip in a sneer of both contempt and disgust. Half a herd of cattle lay dead in their paddock. 50 animals, poisoned by something in the food, according to the vet. On the other video window, Ms. Sharma, UN representative for the Maldives, waited silently. She was attempting to maintain a stone face, and failing. The slaughter represented the third act of full-blown terrorism this month. Vehement was ramping up from a nuisance to a full-blown threat. This was the first time they'd taken lives, though, even if livestock. I hadn't come out and said it, but I considered this an act of war. If I caught up with this group and it came down to an exchange of ordnance, I wouldn't have any ethical issues with taking some of them down. I admitted to myself that I really didn't know if I'd be able to pull the trigger. It was one thing to talk war, it was another entirely to actually take a human life. But I would want to. That much I was sure of. Food supply continued to become more critical as Earth's climate deteriorated. Over half of the 35 remaining enclaves around the planet were at least partly dependent on food subsidies from our orbital farms. The Maldives were still nominally self-supporting, but this assault on their food capacity would mean we'd have to kick in, at least in the short term. Representative Sharma finally couldn't hold it in any longer.
This is senseless. Senseless. Cattle? What have they proven? What have they accomplished? Cowards.
I nodded at every word. For all the bickering in the UN, the various representatives were united in their hatred and contempt for vehement. After an event like this, I could probably push through any special measure I wanted to, with little debate or opposition. Too bad I didn't have anything in my queue.
This is going to hurt, Miss Sharma. Those cattle represent a lot of high-quality calories, not to mention the breeding capacity.
I took a moment to check the herd numbers. It's not life-threatening, but it is damaging, I think. If the handlers hadn't noticed the animals getting sick, we could have lost this entire herd, and that would have been devastating.
I will move to set up a task force at the UN meeting tomorrow,
Ms. Sharma said.
I think there's been a general feeling up to now that if we just ignored them and didn't give them the attention they obviously crave, that they'd go away, no longer.
I nodded without comment. I had the pronouncement from Vehement up in another video window. These people were several screws short, but there was no doubt they were deadly serious. The essential message was that humanity had made a mess of the solar system, and it was time for them to bow out and let the universe recover. And because we might be reluctant to go along, Vehement was going to help us toward that goal. Great. Violent, self-absorbed crackpots on top of everything else. I forwarded the missive to Homer, Charles, and Ralph, and also sent a copy on to Bill. Not that he would have any specific ideas, but I'd gotten in the habit of looping him in on everything. I smiled briefly at the thought. Universal Archives. Homer popped in a few milliseconds later.
Number two, I am forced to admit I'm coming up blank. These clowns trump anything I could possibly say, just by existing.
Yep. Just when you think humanity has found the limits of stupid, they go and ratchet up the standard by another notch. I shook my head. We're going to have to modify our schedules to replace the calories that the cattle would have supplied. Got any ideas? Homer bobbed his head back and forth.
Could be. It's just possible that I've been under-reporting production a bit to establish a small surplus. I suppose now would be a good time to notice the error with a gasp of relief. He grinned at me and I smiled back. Homer was full of surprise.